Daniels has published in Nature and the American Journal of Physics, and he is currently writing a book about Rheticus, who is the only apostle of Copernicus. For the year 2002, he was a distinguished scholar in residence at the Peter Wall Institute for Advanced Studies. I heard Dennis Danielson speak. I'd never met him, I'd never heard of him. I heard him speak at a joint meeting of the American Astronomical Society, which is a very large professional society of astronomers, and the American Association of Physics Teachers. There was a joint meeting between these two large professional organizations a few years ago. And Dennis Danielson was speaking there on the great Copernican cliche. And I didn't understand what that was all about, but I went to listen to his talk, and it was a marvelous rendition of the worldviews at the time of Copernicus and Galileo. And I could tell by the sort of interesting take that he took on the literature that he was showing us, that all the things that we've been sort of indoctrinated with about worldviews during those times weren't exactly right as you actually looked at the writings of people at the time. And he gave such a fascinating view into that world that I hadn't had before, that I was very intrigued. And I went up to talk to him afterwards. He's very friendly. And I began to wonder if he was a Christian. I just couldn't, you know, he hadn't said anything like that in his talk. But I just began to feel a presence about him that made me wonder. And I don't know how we got to talking, but somehow it became apparent that we do share this faith in Christ. And then later he came to speak on a similar topic at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, Maryland, and he gave a wonderful colloquium there on the same topic to some of the top astronomers in our country, and it was fabulous. And I asked him if he would come, this has been a year at least, maybe two, if he would come and be a plenary speaker here at this meeting in this year, and I'm so grateful he agreed to do it. And so we're very glad you're here. Are you here with family, or he's actually
I'll explain that.
Taking off family because he has family obligations, and I'm so glad he's offered to come here. So welcome, Dennis Danielson.
Thank you. Well, Jennifer, you've made me blush, and I'd like to change the focus for a minute. You've all been sitting already for half an hour. Can we stand up and sing the doxology? I've rarely had such a generous introduction. As Jennifer has indicated, over the past few years, I've been having more fun than it ought to be legal for a middle-aged man to be having. I never dreamed 10 years ago that I would be speaking to a group of scientists like this. I should just utter a word of gratitude, maybe more than one through the lecture. But this, for me, all started, I think it was 1994, 1995. I went on a trip with my family, and my mother-in-law was along. And I have a wonderful mother-in-law, by the way. And she had heard this guy speak at their church. And she bought one of his tapes and thought, well, Dennis would be interested in this. I've seen him around. I don't see him in the audience tonight. It was by Hugh Ross. And that was just like a little pebble that started an avalanche for me. And so one of the things I insist upon, of course, is that most history of science is written in language. And language is my area. And so this, I didn't ask anybody's permission really, but I pried the door open and entered, and I've been having a marvelous time since then, learning everything I possibly could about the history of cosmology, particularly. Jennifer mentioned my book very generously. Thank you. There are lots of different pronunciations of Heraclitus or Heraclitus. It doesn't matter. He doesn't mind. One wag looked at the first chapter, which was from the book of Genesis, and looked at the last chapter, which is by Owen Gingrich, and said, well, you shouldn't have called it From Heraclitus to Hawking. You should have called it From Genesis to Gingrich. The alliteration didn't work quite as well. I should also point out that the title is not a sheer act of hubris. If I were holding in my left hand the joy of cooking, I wouldn't actually be holding in my left hand the joy of cooking. I'd be holding a book that referred to the joy of cooking. And the book of the cosmos really refers to that book of nature, the book of the cosmos that God made in this two books theme that we've heard enunciated a number of times at this conference so far. So it points to that other book of God's. It's a wonderful privilege for me to be here tonight. It's also quite terrifying because I'm always conscious when I'm speaking to scientists that I'm not a pictures guy, I'm a language guy. So I don't have PowerPoint or overheads or pictures. I was encouraged this afternoon, someone at one of the sessions pointed out, how can we make all these inferences about the universe and be so cocksure when by our own principles we're saying that 96% of it isn't visible. And what we can pick up, only, what was the term that someone used, one octave band of colors is actually visible with the eye. So you can treat what I'm saying tonight as dark matter, if you like. One more brief word of apologia. Apart from the connection I've already explained to you, why is a guy who's an English prof studying Copernicus and other such writers and thinkers? I spent part of my career as a Miltonist. I still count, I think, as a Miltonist, a student of John Milton, who wrote Paradise Lost, as you all know. Milton wrote in the 17th century. And also, by the way, tonight I'm trying to learn this scientific vocabulary. So I'm not going to talk about the 17th century. I'm going to talk about look-back time of 300 to 500 years. So roughly from the death of Copernicus, which was also the year of the publication of the De Revolutionibus, to the appearance of Newton's Principia Mathematica. This was also a great period of English literature. Includes all the plays of Shakespeare, Paradise Lost by Milton. Milton actually met Galileo in 1638 and 1639. And Galileo is the only contemporary of Milton's whom he mentions by name in Paradise Lost. I think that's quite exciting and quite significant. Milton looked upon Galileo some years later in a speech that he wrote for the English Parliament and saw him as a symbol of someone who was suffering under a kind of ecclesiastical regime that he, Milton, did not want in England. So this has given me a kind of historical and chronological access to the period of the scientific revolution and to people like Kepler, Pascal, Newton, and so on. I've become particularly interested in Copernicus and the first century or so of Copernicanism. Partly because they're so fascinating in themselves, and also because they are so often invoked by modern day scientists and people who comment on science, even in our video tonight. And this is where I stick my oar in as a book person. Because like any literary historian, I'm interested to know how things get interpreted and what they mean. And so I've been very interested in what people think Copernicus and Copernicanism mean for the history of science, and for Earth and human beings generally. Now, some of what I'm going to say about this, Jennifer would have heard 2 years ago, but there'll be quite a bit that is new as well. Now, I'm sure that most of you are familiar with the standard interpretation of Copernicanism, and I'm just going to sketch it and see if it jibes with what you have heard or been taught at whatever point in your life. When I went to school, I was taught that the Copernican revelation entailed a humiliation or a demotion or a dethroning of Earth, and by implication, humankind, from its previous place of cosmic centrality and importance. In other words, I was taught that the scientific smashing of geocentrism, the teaching that Earth is in the center, in the 16th and 17th century, 300 to 500 years, look back time, entailed a rejection of anthropocentrism, a belief not so much that human beings were geometrically central, but in terms of the value system of the universe, if you like, human beings were central. And in effect, the full kind of stage version of this transformation features the dark forces of religion and the church locked in mortal combat with the enlightening power of science. Science has demonstrated the insignificance of humankind in the universe overall, and it has established, science has established, you guessed it, the centrality and importance of scientists in showing us how cosmically unimportant we are. Well, I'm coloring this picture, but do you recognize it? Now, although I've referred to this as a standard interpretation, let me get the emphasis on the right word, although I've referred to this as the standard interpretation, it's so standard that most people don't treat it as an interpretation at all. It's just a fact of history. And many science textbooks treat it as such. Although I've had a few editors of science textbooks who were at my lecture 2 years ago in San Diego write to me, telling me that in the revision of their textbook they had put a few things right. And that just tickled me immensely, of course. So, over the past few years, I've been on a little campaign to undermine this interpretation and to suggest that really it's not the way things are at all. I've been calling the standard interpretation, as Jennifer indicated, the great Copernican cliche. And I've been attacking it not only because I believe that it's false, it's a pretty good reason for attacking it, but also because I think that its effects have been and continue to be harmful. So let me sketch, if I may, my reasons for considering the great Copernican cliche to be wrong. To start with, the cliche rests on a false idea about the cosmology that preceded Copernicus and which he overturned. It incorrectly presumes that Earth's cosmographic centrality in pre-Copernican thought implied Earth's privilege or specialness. In fact, I think I've worked hard at looking for contrary evidence. To the very best of my knowledge, the overwhelmingly dominant pre-Copernican view was that the central position in the universe was one of humility. Now, you've just had a little primer on Aristotelian physics. There's only one quibble I'd have with it. In fact, the planets in Aristotelian physics are circling around, well, in a way they're circling around the Earth, but actually they're circling around the center of the universe. And the Earth just happens to be there. Now, that's not just splitting hairs. The Earth happens to be there because Earth, of the four Aristotelian elements, five if you include quintessence or the ether, Earth, water, air, and fire, of those four, Earth, and Earth is made of Earth, is the heaviest. And so it seeks the central position in the universe. It's there because it's heavy. And an ultimate improvement of the of the lot of human beings who live on the face of the earth involves their rising upward, away from the center. Away from what Pico, in the 15th century, 500 years ago, called the excrementary and filthy parts of the lower world. Excuse my language in church. But that's what he called the earth. The excrementary, another word for that, the excrementary and filthy parts of the lower world. And by the way, in this model, people whose lot got worse rather than better ended up even closer to the center than they were when they lived on the surface of the earth. The surface of the earth, by definition, is one ER from the center of the universe. And that's why Dante, in his Divine Comedy, places hell right in the center. The dead center. The pits of the universe. And if you look at the center of Dante's universe, you don't find that it's a place of privilege. You find it's a place of damnation. And again, I'm trying to be precise in my language. You'll find Satan there, and he's damned cold. He's frozen solid in the pit of hell. And it's Dante's picture of total loss of life and dynamism. That's the center of the pre-Copernican universe. And that's why Arthur Lovejoy, back in the 1930s, quipped that the Ptolemaic universe is not anthropocentric, but diabolocentric. So in any case, the first assertion in my argument, and by the way, scientists tend to do show and tell. I do tell and tell. It's an argument. The first assertion in the argument is that for Copernicus to remove Earth from that kind of central location could not possibly count as a demotion. On the contrary, as Rheticus, whom Jennifer kindly mentioned, Copernicus's only student, this is how he put it in the first ever published Copernican treatise. In the heliocentric theory, he explains, quote, "The globe of the earth has risen while the sun has descended to the center of the universe." In many ways, in Copernican cosmology, the sun has gone down. And another way to put this is that after geocentrism, Earth had nowhere to go but up. So rejecting geocentrism emphatically does not entail a demotion of Earth or of humankind. So the next step in my argument is to claim that geocentrism does not imply anthropocentrism. Okay, to move from the non, this is a mouthful, but to move from the non-anthropocentric character of pre-Copernican geocentrism to the anthropocentric tenor of much Copernican cosmology. In other words, there's much in Copernicus and his followers which is more anthropocentric than anything you'll find in Ptolemaic cosmology. Copernicus himself refers in De Revolutionibus to God as the great architect. And he says that God created the world propter nos, for our sakes, or because of us. But this really takes off with Galileo. Galileo reads Earth's non-centrality and its corresponding planetary status as an exaltation. Some of you may have read The Starry Messenger, or the Sidereus Nuncius, in which Galileo demonstrates that light travels a two-way street in the universe. When he looked through his telescope at the moon, he could see that the dark side of the moon was gently illuminated. And he reasoned correctly that the dark side of the moon was being illuminated by the reflected rays of the sun's light reflected from the earth, just as the earth receives the reflected rays of the sun via the moon. And this was a was a wonderful demonstration of something that Debbie mentioned last night. She gave Newton credit. I'd like to give Galileo a little bit of credit. Newton proved that the laws of gravitation are the same on Earth as in heaven and vice versa. Galileo, with this demonstration, showed that the laws, the behavior of light and reflection, are the same in heaven and on Earth. And so, not only was Earth no longer, let me put it positively, Earth was now a planet, but in the classical sense, that also meant that the Earth was a star. And it meant, and this was decisive for the genre of science fiction, that if you were outside of Earth, if you were on the moon or somewhere else, you could look down and you could see Earth. Again, in the pre-Copernican cosmology, the physics of that weren't in place. And so although there were some pre-Copernican authors who imagined looking at the Earth, it was really Galileo who brought this onto center stage. And he says that the phenomenon of Earthshine illuminating the moon proves that Earth indeed shines like a star. And you've got to go and read this for yourselves, that you can just feel the enthusiasm of Galileo and the sense of exaltation. He says, this account, and I'm quoting, disproves those who assert principally on the grounds that it has neither light nor motion, that the Earth must be excluded from the dance of the stars. For the Earth does have motion. It surpasses the moon in brightness, and it is not the sump where the universe's filth and ephemera collect. You can see again here the model that Pico referred to, the filthy and excrementary parts of the lower world. Galileo uses the Latin word sentina, which was used to describe the very bottom of a ship beneath the lowest floorboards. It's where the bilge waters collected. It was a kind of sump vis-a-vis the ship, and that's why I've translated it sump. The Earth is no longer, in the Copernican view, which Galileo is promoting, the sump where the universe's filth and ephemera collect. And some years later in the dialogue, Galileo's spokesperson Salviati says essentially the same thing, and I'm quoting again, "As for the Earth, we seek to ennoble and perfect it when we strive to make it like the celestial bodies, and as it were, place it in heaven." Does that sound like a demotion? So rather than engineering a demotion for humankind, or for Earth, what Copernicus made possible was our inclusion in the dance of the stars, our active participation in the harmony and in the polyphony of the universe, of the heavenly chorus. And of course, Kepler was the one who most decisively latched on to the metaphor of harmony, as you know, and that's another chapter in the story. But Kepler believed that our position on Earth as a planet was vital to our perceiving the glories of the universe and in turn glorifying God properly. Kepler, in this way, reconceptualizes centrality. He points out that Earth, in its orbit, has the Sun and Mercury and Venus on one side of it, and Mars and Jupiter and Saturn on the other. So it's in the middle, not in the geometrical center point, but in the middle of those great bodies. Moreover, because it's a moving position, a moving space platform, he doesn't use exactly that term, but I'll tell you in a moment the term he does use. We are in a position to do our triangulations and our calculations and our observations of this magnificent structure. Kepler says, because man was created for contemplation and adorned and equipped with eyes, he could not remain at rest in the center. On the contrary, he must make an annual journey on this boat, which is our Earth, to perform his observations. There is no globe nobler or more suitable for man than Earth, for it is exactly in the middle of the principal globes, and so on. For Kepler, then, only with the abolition of geocentrism may we truly say that we occupy the best, most privileged place in the universe. And just by the way, Kepler also believed that there were inhabitants on Jupiter. And Jupiter, by this reasoning, was not in the ideal position in the universe. But God is a gracious God, and in Kepler's view, he gave him a few extra moons to look at by way of consolation. To summarize, then, there's not a great deal in the picture I've sketched so far to suggest that Copernicanism demoted humankind, nor that Copernicanism was objected to by religious parties or anybody else on the grounds that it demoted humankind. It was objected to because it ran counter to centuries of established astronomical tradition. It was objected to because it involved the absurd idea that terra firma was in motion. Let me just look around you. It's not, obviously, right? Galileo's version of Copernicanism was objected to because it seemed to contradict a few passages of Scripture, which, if read literally, as the Council of Trent had decreed that they should be read, suggested that the Earth did not move. And in fact, it was objected to because it seemed to entail a dethroning not of the Earth, but of the Sun. Placing it, the Sun, in what had been the location of greatest disrepute in the universe. And this is why, by the way, Copernicus, in De Revolutionibus 1.10, has to pull out all those poetic stops when he describes the location of the Sun in the center. This is one of the most famous and most poetic passages of his writing. Quote, "And behold, in the midst of all resides the Sun. For who in this most beautiful temple would set this lamp in another or a better place whence to illuminate all things at once? Truly indeed does the Sun, as if seated upon a royal throne, govern his family of planets as they circle about him." Copernicus must try to renovate the cosmic basement if it is to be a fit dwelling for the exalted, for the honorable Sun. And to put this in a slightly circular way, he needed to renovate the basement because the basement needed renovating. For as Galileo would put it later, it had been the sump of the physical universe. And so for Copernicus purposes, it needed a good deal of spiffing up. This renovative reading is supported by the fact that within 1 year of the publication of De Revolutionibus, a priest in Italy by the name of Giovanni Tolosani was condemning Copernicus on just these grounds. Copernicus, says Tolosani, with indignation in 1544, and I'm quoting, "puts the Sun in the center of the universe, where everybody else correctly and most convincingly proves the Earth is. Copernicus," still quoting, "puts the indestructible Sun in a place subject to destruction." It just didn't compute if you were still thinking in terms of Aristotelian physics. But Rheticus, Copernicus' student, had already anticipated this sort of rigorous either-or, win-lose, zero-sum game logic. And so when he was preparing the grounds for Copernicanism back in 1540, he devoted much poetic and rhetorical effort to establishing a win-win reading of the relocation of both Earth and Sun. "As far as Earth is concerned," he says, Rheticus says, "it is clearer than sunlight that the circle which carries the Earth is rightly called the Great Circle, Orbis Magnus. If generals have received the surname Great on account of successful exploits in war or conquests of people, surely this circle deserves to have that august name applied to it." He's referring to the orbit of the Earth again. "For almost alone," he says, "it makes us share in the laws of the celestial state." Now, in this win-win construction, this encomium upon the greatness of Earth's location, Rheticus also offers a solar counterpart. And anticipating his teacher, Copernicus, Rheticus emphasizes the sun's royalty. It was called by the ancients, he says, leader, governor of nature, and king. Moreover, my teacher is aware that in human affairs, the emperor need not himself hurry from city to city in order to perform the duty imposed upon him by God. The heart does not move to the head or the feet or other parts of the body to sustain a living creature. You see how he's creating an analogy that supports the dignity, the honorable status of the sun, even while engaging in the relocation of the sun to the center. So Rheticus published those words in 1540. And really nothing, well, unless you can find something that I haven't been able to find, nothing for about the next 100 years suggests that Copernicus is putting the Earth into orbit, into what had been the sun's place, was interpreted as locating the Earth on the other side of the tracks, cosmically speaking. It was not interpreted in a depreciatory sense. Only in the mid-17th century, 100 years after the death of Copernicus, with the preliminary glimmerings of the Enlightenment, did the now standard interpretation start to appear in the writings of some French satirists, such as Cyrano de Bergerac and Bouvier de Fontenelle, who you probably don't study in your physics courses, but yeah. Bernard Bouvier de Fontenelle says, "I am extremely pleased." I can't do a French accent, so I won't try. "I'm extremely pleased with Copernicus for having humbled the vanity of mankind, who had usurped the first and best situation in the universe." So this take on Copernicanism became the apparently unquestioned version of the Enlightenment almost overnight, it seems. Towards the end of the 17th century, the beginning of the 18th century. By the beginning of the 19th century, it's put magisterially like this by Goethe. Goethe writes in his Farbenlehre, "Perhaps no discovery or opinion ever produced a greater effect on the human spirit than did the teaching of Copernicus. No sooner was the earth recognized as being round and self-contained that it was obliged to relinquish the colossal privilege of being the center of the universe." And from Goethe's time until the present, there's been almost no looking back. Now that's the first half of my talk. That's the more historical side of my talk. I want to move into our own lifetimes now and look at this standard interpretation of Copernicanism, particularly in connection with one of its most famous spokespeople, Carl Sagan, from whose title I've taken my title tonight, The Tale of the Pale Blue Dot. He doesn't call it a tale. I'm calling it a tale because I'm wanting to raise it to a level of critical awareness. It is a tale. And there's another tale that I would like to tell. Carl Sagan described Copernicanism as the first in a series of great demotions delivered to human pride. And here's just one brief version of how Sagan puts it. "Our ancestors lived out of doors." It's almost what you heard in the film tonight. "Our ancestors lived out of doors. The sun, the moon, the planets, and the stars are part of some elegantly configured cosmic clockwork, put here for a purpose, for our benefit. That's how it seemed to them. Who else makes use of them? What else are they good for?" And Sagan moves very briskly from this picture, all of which I won't quote. He's a wonderful writer. He moves from that to his standard interpretation. And I will read the last paragraph here. "This satisfying demonstration of importance of our specialness, buttressed by daily observations of the heavens, made the geocentrist conceit a transcultural conceit, taught in the schools, built into the language, part and parcel of great literature and sacred scripture. Dissenters were discouraged sometimes with torture and death. It is no wonder that for the vast bulk of human history, no one questioned it. Now, I just want to be perfectly clear that I consider this mainly hokum. Sagan's tale of the pale blue dot, which pours scorn on the suggestion that this cosmic speck is profoundly special, is nevertheless only the most prominent and famous example of the same kind of interpretation I've been talking about so far, about the legacy of Copernicus. And I invite you, after tomorrow morning when you go home, to go and do a Google search and punch in Copernicus and the word dethroned, and just see how many hits you get that enunciate exactly the same view as I've just characterized with the words of Carl Sagan. Let me just cite a few more examples of the cliché, or its narrative form, which I'm calling the tale of the pale blue dot, and how it's had a bad effect on how we understand science and perhaps the universe. As Sagan's phrase, "the emotions of human pride," suggests, he and others see the so-called demotion of Earth by Copernicus as part of a larger pattern. This particular approach broadly sees the Earth dethroned by Copernicus, the Sun and in turn the Milky Way dethroned by subsequent generations of astronomers, the species Homo sapiens dethroned by Darwin, and reason or spirit dethroned by Sigmund Freud. And Freud himself was very fond of this genealogy, because of course it meant that if you opposed his view, then you were probably disreputably medieval in your cosmology as well. Now, just sticking with cosmology, consider Stephen Hawking's critique in A Brief History of Time of something that was mentioned this morning, the anthropic principle. Now, he's going after the strong anthropic principle, and maybe Keel and Stockton this morning were presenting a weaker version of the anthropic principle. Nevertheless, the anthropic principle is a serious scientific theory which is put forward in response to the astonishing fact that consciousness, apparently, against all odds, has arisen in this attenuated sea of matter we call the universe. And one of Hawking's main reasons for rejecting the strong anthropic principle is as follows, and I quote Hawking, another wonderful writer, "because it runs against the tide of the whole history of science. We have developed from the geocentric cosmologies of Ptolemy and his forebears through the heliocentric cosmology of Copernicus and Galileo to the modern picture in which the Earth is a medium-sized planet orbiting around an average..." "in the outer suburbs of an ordinary spiral galaxy, which is itself only one of about a million galaxies in the observable universe. Yet the strong anthropic principle would claim that this whole vast construction exists simply for our sake. This is very hard to believe," end of quote. Now, I'm critiquing Hawking's argument not because I'm here to defend the strong anthropic principle, but because I think that ideas should be judged on their own merits, on the evidence, on their coherence. And in fact, what Hawking appears to be doing, by contrast, is rejecting the anthropic principle, not because it fails on logical or evidentiary grounds, but because it is repugnant to a pre-established way of thinking, which I'm suggesting has very little foundation. In any case, the claim that something is unacceptable because it's hard to believe, I'm not sure, as a non-scientist, really stands up very well as a scientific argument. I don't know if any of you earlier today had difficulty believing in, I don't know, quantum theory or string theory. Well, I did, but that doesn't disprove it. So I'm not objecting also, by the way, to Hawking's point about cosmic geometry. At the literal level, the claim about the non-centrality of the Earth is very firmly established. In standard model cosmology, the non-centrality of any point in the universe is seen as a consequence or an instance of what's sometimes called the principle of mediocrity. And it's also misleadingly called the Copernican principle. That's the last time you're going to hear me use that phrase. Just as the surface of a sphere has no particular center, so in the universe as a whole, there's no midpoint. Or just as truly, you could say, any point is the midpoint. And I was really quite pleased, if shocked, last night to hear Debbie Harzma up here saying, now here we are in the center. Right? Well, it's a kind of observational convenience. There are lots of different ways we use centrality that don't imply, you know, absolute geometrical centrality. The same goes for location. You know, earlier today someone was referring to our local group of galaxies. Local. That's not the kind of meaning we get the local when we're talking over breakfast usually. If you actually look in the program, it's interesting. We have local groups. The first local group consists of Canada, the UK, Switzerland, New Zealand, and the rest of the world. The second local group is Greater Chicago. So we need a word like Chicago-centric view of the universe. Okay. The harmful effects of the great Copernican cliché also appear at a more popular level, where they impair our understanding of new scientific discoveries by forcing them into this preconceived and sort of orthodox picture of Copernicus's legacy. I'm moving down market here. Someone also in one of the sessions mentioned the 1996 meteorite, I think it was, that came from Mars and may have had evidence of life on it. NASA announced in any case that its scientists had discovered in 1996 evidence of life in a meteorite from Mars. And a man by the name of Nathan Myhrvold, who is an executive and self-styled chief strategic daydreamer for the Microsoft Corporation, used the occasion to issue his own denunciation of anthropocentrism. And he first published this in Slate, which is the Microsoft organ. It's an online daily newspaper, and then it was picked up by Time, which is probably owned by Microsoft as well, I'm not sure. And this is what he said about the announcement. Last week's announcement is the biggest insult to the human species in almost 500 years. Step two in a three-step process that will leave humanity totally humbled. Ptolemy was the first and boldest in a long succession of spin doctors for the primacy of human beings. The whole universe, he postulated, rotated around us. But then Copernicus rudely pointed out, sorry, earthlings, we spin around the sun, not vice versa. Giordano Bruno, a sort of 16th century Carl Sagan, popularized these concepts, saying, among other things, that innumerable suns exist, innumerable earths revolve around those suns, living beings inhabit those worlds. A soundbite like that would have gotten Bruno his 15 minutes of TV celebrity if he'd been around last week, but this was 400 years ago, so they roasted him to death instead. Bruno's crime, I'm still quoting, Bruno's crime, like Galileo's, was to undermine the uniqueness of our planet, and by doing so to threaten the intellectual security of the religious dictatorships of his time. People get cranky if you burst their bubbles. Well, there's no denying the verve or the humor of Myhrvold's account, and I don't want to be a complete Scrooge here. But it provides another example in slightly exaggerated form of the great Copernican cliché as repeatedly swallowed uncritically and in the absence of good evidence by scientists and non-scientists alike. I've already indicated in the case of Sagan some of its standard features: failure to distinguish geocentrism from anthropocentrism, failure to distinguish literal and figurative, fast and loose potted summary of what actually happened historically, full-blown us and them rhetoric, instruments of torture standing dramatically at the ready, there on the side of the deceivers, the spin doctors, the religious, the cranky, with the suggestion that, of course, the religious are deceivers, spin doctors, and cranky. Some of us are occasionally. The main point that I'm trying to make is merely that this sort of Punch and Judy account of the history of science detracts from the very discovery that's purportedly being discussed. It does nothing at all to encourage closer, more curious, more open-minded examination of the evidence or its implications. Because, hey, we already know what it means. The great Copernican cliché in this way functions as a sort of unreflective and really, when it comes right down to it, not very interesting knee-jerk response to something that is profoundly interesting, something that genuinely warrants careful attention. This is one of the main reasons why I think the cliché needs to be dispensed with. Okay, so there you have my little sketch of the campaign that I've been running, and you're welcome to join the campaign. In pursuing it, I've met with a number of very interesting and challenging responses. Among scientists, I've discovered to my cost that a lot of people went into astronomy in the first place because they were inspired by Carl Sagan. And these loyal folk are not made particularly comfortable by my efforts to dethrone him. Other than that, I've had a fairly friendly response from scientists, short of my argument actually being accepted. After the plenary lecture at the AAS that Jennifer mentioned earlier, I had a lot of comments from people saying, yes, well, thank you very much, interesting insight. Of course, it can't be right. What about Galileo? And one senior professor of astronomy from the South took me aside afterwards. He didn't exactly use the words, no, listen here, Sonny, but that was the tone of his comments. And he said, no, this sort of verbal or written evidence that you present, scientists are likely to find that too clever by half. I have no idea how to respond to criticism like that. Okay, there's one more thing I want to say about this dethroning business that I haven't acknowledged yet. I've been keeping it under wraps. And that's it. That is the Earth's relatively small size, cosmically speaking, or extraordinarily small size, cosmically speaking. If you're an astronomer and you spend your days calculating galaxy populations per cubic gigaparsec, then you're bound to think of Earth as pretty small, to put it mildly. And accordingly, Sagan and other proponents of his approach believe that just as the march of science has shown that we humans are not centrally located in the universe, and therefore not special, so it has demonstrated that we're very small, and therefore not special. Now, it's worth pointing out here that the scientific recognition of Earth's smallness is nothing new. I won't digress long on this, but Ptolemy himself had a series of very good arguments proving that, as far as we can tell, Earth is as a point in relation to the size of the sphere of the fixed stars. So, yes, Copernicus's universe is bigger, and by my calculations it's about 2 billion times bigger, because Copernicus has an argument showing that the orbit, the great circle, is itself as a point in relation to the sphere of the fixed stars. Nevertheless, in each of those cosmologies, the Earth is unimaginably small compared to the universe as a whole. But if I can respond to this smallness argument with another tautology, size is important, only if size is important. And in spite of those darn pesky spam emails I keep getting, it's just not true that bigger equals better. Literal greatness, or size, does not imply figurative or axiological greatness, greatness of value, excellence, importance. And literal smallness doesn't entail insignificance. I'm so glad to hear someone in one of the sessions this afternoon saying, size doesn't matter very much to God. Our devotional this morning focused on the all and on the sparrow. You know, one winter when my wife and I were in our 20s and we were both going to graduate school in different places in California, she was near LA and I was in the Bay Area, we had to spend two terms apart, and we'd visit each other every few weekends. And I remember taking her to the San Jose airport and dropping her off and kissing her goodbye, and then standing at the fence and watching her plane take off and become smaller and smaller and smaller until it's just a speck in the misty skies of California. And I wondered to myself, I just thought, how can the person in the universe who's most important to me, they're so small? You could give me your own examples of that kind of experience. In this and many other examples, we emphatically do not conclude, aha, see then how trivial and insignificant she is. Or you'd better not. On the contrary, we search, whether we're literary people or not, we search for metaphors to express how worth may be embodied in tiny things, how love is not something merely bound by space or physical magnitude, how a jewel may dwarf in value the kingdom that contains it. And in the same way, surely a meditation on our pale blue dot requires a balancing of perspectives. Of course it imparts a healthy humility to realize how little we and our planet are. But it also fills us with awe to contemplate the inestimable riches concentrated in that small, pale blue point of reflected light. And I want to conclude with just two thought experiments, which in some ways harmonize with Carl Sagan's imaginative method, but which point in the opposite direction. Sagan, of course, asks us, in an imaginative journey to the outer regions of the solar system, to look back at our pale blue dot and, quote, then try to convince yourself that God created the whole universe for one of the 10 million or so species of life that inhabit that speck of dust. I'm actually not sure who really says that. I mean, we can say that God made the world for us, but who says that God made the world merely for us? Anyway, I'd like to imagine pointing the telescope in the opposite direction in search of some other planet like ours, preferably one that contains intelligent life. And just before we do that, I want to tell you parenthetically about a young boy named Jonathan Biggs, who lives in Kelowna, British Columbia. I went to school with his father. I've never met Jonathan, and I don't know too much about him, but I know this. I know that he has Down syndrome. I know that a few months ago, he fell in love with Cinderella at Disney World in Florida. And I know that if you ask him his name, he says something like, I am Jothan. Now back to our scenario, our search for ET. Suppose one day soon, some of our astronomical colleagues discover an Earth-like planet somewhere out there in the galaxy. Suppose they discover that this planet contains some kind of intelligent life. And suppose somehow overcoming the barrier represented by the speed of light, they make radio contact with one of that planet's inhabitants. Finally, suppose these colleagues ask that inhabitant its name, and he replies, "I am Jotham," and perhaps goes on to explain in very simple language that he fell in love with that planet's equivalent of Cinderella at that planet's equivalent of Disney World. Now imagine the headlines the next morning in the Denver Post. Is there any doubt but that they would mention the discovery? Is there any doubt but that it would be treated as one of the greatest astronomical discoveries humankind has ever made? However, do you think that the story would open by explaining apologetically that the intelligent life didn't appear to have as high an IQ as Einstein, or that the ET's body was less than 2 meters in length, or that the planet it inhabited was a paltry 8,000 miles in diameter, or that it had orbited a very ordinary garden variety G-class yellow star situated in no particularly distinguished location on the edge of the galaxy? I don't know exactly how the story would be told, but don't you think that it would gush with sheer astonishment at the news that the universe out there contains life that thinks and communicates and loves and has a name? You already discern my point. If such a discovery said something momentous and significant about the nature of the universe, then our existence does too. The truth is, that Jonathan Biggs does exist in the universe. And in strict consistency with the cosmological principle of mediocrity, the fact that he exists here rather than there is neither here nor there. In the past, when I've given lectures like this, I've more than once been asked, if intelligent life were discovered elsewhere in the universe, what would it do to your theology? And having thought about it, I believe the answer is that it would do the same thing that discovering intelligent life on Earth does to my theology. It fills me with awe. It drives me to ask telic questions about the purpose of life. It makes me ask who or what I am in relation to other intelligent beings. It fills me with gratitude that I can live in the same world and share a moment in time with other contingent creatures. And it fills me with wonder that there is something rather than nothing. The final thought experiment I want to share with you was proposed by the English poet Thomas Traherne back in the 17th century, about 340 years ago, in the wake of the Copernican Revolution. You know, the revolution that supposedly dethroned Earth and the human race. Traherne was a contemporary of Newton's, and also of others I've mentioned, such as Fontenelle, and he illustrates the viability then of the alternative interpretation of Copernicanism that I'm proposing now. The lost manuscript of this meditation by Traherne, entitled The Kingdom of God, was discovered 5 years ago and published only within the last 12 months. It begins by sketching a scenario that partakes richly in the Copernican imagination, and postulates, like Sagan, someone viewing Earth from outer space, but it offers a profoundly different view of this, our home and native planet, and it is the alternative, and I think much more truly Copernican tale of the pale blue dot that I'd like to leave you with tonight. Traherne writes, had a man been always in one of the stars, or confined to the body of the flaming sun, or surrounded with nothing but pure ether, at vast and prodigious distances from the earth, acquainted with nothing but the azure sky and face of heaven, little could he dream of any treasures hidden in that azure veil afar off. Should he be let down on a sudden and see the sea and the effects of those influences he never dreamed of, such strange kind of creatures, such mysteries and varieties, such never heard of colors, such a new and lively green in the meadows, such odoriferous and fragrant flowers, such reviving and refreshing winds, it would make him cry out, "How blessed are thy holy people! How divine, how highly exalted! Heaven itself is under their feet. The earth seems to swell with pride that it bears them all. All its treasures laugh and sing to serve them. Verily, this star is a nest of angels. This little star, so wide and so full of mysteries, so capacious and full of territories, containing innumerable repositories of delight when we draw near. Who would have expected and who could have hoped for such enjoyments?" Thank you for sharing this time. I can try to take questions. Yeah.
Let's take a few questions.
I've been trying to figure out who was the most influenced Carl Sagan in developing his principle of mediocrity and what the verdict is. I think I traced it perhaps to Harlan Shapley with those stars of men. Have you been able to trace it directly to
the question is who was the main influence, or who might have been the main influence on Carl Sagan's application of the principle of mediocrity, and the suggestion is that it was Harlow Shapley. Sorry, I talk about the 20th century, but I do history of science in the 16th and 17th century. I really don't know whom Sagan read or by whom he was most influenced. So I would guess that your speculation is. It's better than mine because I don't have one.
How about Harry? How would you respond to a counter argument that even Copernican supporters of the Carbon Revolution was misinterpreted the history of science by them since then as been motivated by the sense of deinterpretation? Taking man off the throne and taking the worldview of the
system. Well, I tried to respond to that in part. The question was, even if one buys my argument as far as Copernicus and his immediate followers is concerned, how would one respond to the claim that science since then, with a kind of, you know, if it is an infinitization of the universe and so on, results in a making of human beings smaller and smaller? I guess I probably showed my hand indicating that smallness is only one part of the cosmic picture. Those who are enthusiasts for the anthropic principle might claim that the largeness is a function of the need for us, or some version of us. Right? So it's sort of depending on what is the cart and what is the horse. You know, we're not here just because the universe is so large. The universe is so large because, in Paul Davies' words, it saw us coming, and we were truly meant to be here. I fall back on Psalm 8, frankly, that balancing of perspectives. When I consider the heavens the work of thy fingers, what is man that thou art mindful of him? And that can be very small, or it can be microscopically small, or, you know, 10 to the minus whatever small. But still, we have voices and we have purpose. You know, if we want to ask whether there's purpose in the universe, well, we came here with a purpose. And we are part of the universe, so there's purpose in the universe. Now, that's a very local sample, I understand. But for me, the strong point about the weak anthropic principle, and maybe the slightly stronger version of the anthropic principle, is that you cannot produce a satisfactory theory of the universe unless you take into account the fact that you and I communicate and love and have purposes and all those good things.
I have some questions. Are you way back to that back row? Oh, let me take these guys here.
What I'm saying is you are using the preservation of the terms of the sense of the view of the science relevant. But I want to ask you this question. Is Bruce's characterization, the discarding of man's place, is determined on how to treat the current universe, and how the current universe upset that comfortable universe on so
long. What's the last adjective you used?
Comfortable.
Comfortable, okay. Yes. The question was, how would I respond to the view put forward by C.S. Lewis in The Discarded Image, in which Lewis is presenting a very sympathetic view of what he's referring to as the discarded image, namely the model, broadly speaking, that obtained in Europe before the time of Copernicus, which I think he used the word comfortable, didn't you? That in some degree it was comfortable for humankind. It was comfortable in the way in which something's comfortable for me if I'm, you know, off relaxing by myself and nobody's paying a great deal of attention to me. That one of the wonderful phrases that Lewis coins in that book is the claim that in the medieval world view, of the world was a view of the world that was anthropo-peripheral. You know, the real action was taking place up there in the heavens. And I'm quite willing to accept that there are elements of discomfort that come along with any kind of promotion. You know, there are greater responsibilities when you get promoted. And when Earth is promoted to become one of the stars, you know, there's more science to be done, and you're a little bit off balance because you're now told that this thing that you're on is moving in a number of different ways. You know, and we have a few, not a lot, but a few examples of discomfort shown in response to that new cosmology. I think the main point, though, is that it is and was seen as an exaltation and an opportunity to go places, humanly speaking. And I would add this to it. I actually think in this regard, Copernicanism is more biblical than the pre-Copernican Ptolemaic view that Lewis is very fond of. Because this sort of bad-mouthing of the earth, filthy and excrementary parts of the lower world, that's not biblical language. That's language which is borrowed from the classical philosophy, as I've indicated from Aristotle and others, which sees the earth as literally the pit of the universe. That's not a teaching we find in the Bible. The earth is a pretty special place in the Bible, and it's worth taking care of. It's not detritus.
Critics come up to you and say, Carl Sagan inspired me. I'm an astronomy because of him. Why is, I can answer why he's so inspiring. Do we not have to take account of this? Why is this picture of the enthronement of Earth so inspiring to people? It's not just attractive, it changes the course of their lives.
Yeah, it does.
And I find this really rather challenging.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't, by the way, I hope I haven't communicated any disrespect for Carl Sagan. I'm not saying that just because there might be some fans here. Carl Sagan played an important role, and there's more to Carl Sagan than the bits that I've produced tonight. So I wouldn't want to jump to the conclusion that it was necessarily those precise bits that inspired people. You would know this better than I. What I do know is that there are many prominent astronomers. Back in the January issue of Natural History, Neil deGrasse Tyson from the Hayden Planetarium wrote an article called "Delusions of Centrality," which trotted out the same stuff, we've talked about this, and he knew that I would disagree with it. So his editor wrote me a kind letter asking if I would like to respond to this, and he warned me, 300 word maximum. You know, it's really hard to get all this stuff down to 300 words. So I spent a whole weekend trying to get everything down to 300 words. Did use my word counter. 300 words exactly, and I sent it off. The editor said, well, we're going to use this letter, don't worry, we're going to use it. And then it came out, it was 138 words, half of the guts taken out of it, and then Tyson in turn replied to that letter saying, well, my point can be attacked in these pointillistic ways, but the whole history of science supports what I'm saying, and it's not disproved by, and he used the term, the phantasmagoria of Pico and Galileo. So I don't know, it's frustrating. It's just part of the sort of set that people have, and I know I need scientists' help with this to try and kind of prize open a crack in the armor.
I'll take a couple more. There's one gentleman, sorry, Larry, just about hit. He's been trying to.
You talked a little bit about how you have been received scientifically.
Yeah.
What about in your own discipline, your colleagues in the Modern Language Association, with their emphasis on postmodern and so on?
I've had a wonderful time. they don't necessarily. You know what it's like if you're sort of doing something and people don't know what you're up to? They're sort of respectful in a very low-key, curious way. And so I just tell them that what I'm doing is interdisciplinary. And you know what it's like in the university. You know, if it's interdisciplinarity, it's okay. I'm partly facetious and partly serious. I am doing stuff that's interdisciplinary. I've had, actually in my home department, I give my home department and my home university absolutely full marks for giving me encouragement in this work. They don't always know what I'm up to, but they encourage it, and I have to say I'm very grateful to them.
Okay, one here, and then Larry, because he's my friend. Okay.
From your history, from your knowledge, can I ask you to look into the future, if you would, if you're comfortable, and tell me whether, I don't know, 400 years from now, someone looking at our present they make an analogy between the pre-Copernican and geocentric view and all the true morals that that had, perhaps thankfully without violence, and the evolution the creationist struggles of the present time. Is there a parallel to that at all?
The question is, I'm going to buy time by repeating it, 400 years from now, will people, perhaps historians of science, look back and see some kind of analogy between the present-day evolutionary or evolutionist and anti-evolutionist struggle and the, for want of a better set of categories, the Copernican versus Ptolemaic struggle? 400 years into the future, I may be rash, but I'm not that rash. I would love it if someone else would answer for me. I have no idea, because I know so very little, really, about that particular problem. And there's enough of a spectrum of opinion on that matter here tonight that we could set those people at each other's throats. Right.
Okay, last one, Larry Woolman.
Actually, I don't have a question, but I want to answer your question, at least the first answer, why is Carl Sagan inspiring? I don't think it was because he'd be from people, because to read between the lines is just the opposite. I think he's from reading and human reading to a great height. So it wasn't people one way or the other. I think it was because we're using them to Debbie's cross Friday night. We all in wonder of the universe is what came across.
Oh, yes.
The billions and billions. And that inspires people. And I don't see it, although the punchline is different Friday night, I don't see it as different in the
Okay. So, did everyone hear that? Yes? Good. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.